This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you. Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the, hey Marge, did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Running a growing business means getting the insights you need wherever you are. With Shopify's single dashboard, you can manage orders, shipping, and payments from anywhere. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States, and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ifanboy, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ifanboy now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to iFanboys Talksplode with Gene Luen Yang.
Well, when does school let's out? Or in a chef's day done? Get the boys together. I'm gonna get a ball and a run.
Hey, this is Josh Flanagan from iFanboy.com. This is another episode of our creator interview podcast, Talksplode. And today we have cartoonist genius Gene Luen Yang on the show. He just started a series of Shang-Chi comics. He did Superman Smashes the Clan recently. And, of course, the new book, Dragon Hoops. I'm a huge fan. It's a really fun conversation, so enjoy. I'm excited to welcome Gene Luen Yang today to the show.
Thanks for having me, Josh. I'm excited to be here.
That's fantastic. I think we had you on the video show a really long time ago, probably before I knew how to talk to people on a video show. So this will be sort of like the first time we've actually spoken. And let's see. I'll just start with where I just read Dragon Hoops. I did not know it was going to be a thing that came out, and you know, it just sort of showed up one day, and I went, oh. And I was instantly sucked in for many reasons, largely because, you know, I do not have and we can explain what the book is in a second, but I do not have a very strong relationship with sports, but I like it. I love sports from a documentary standpoint, from a historical standpoint, from a storytelling standpoint, and so you've got your story mixed in with this story of a team. And I felt like as you were going through it, I was relating to this idea of being able to finally find a way to get into it and understand it in a different way.
Thanks, man. Thanks for reading it. I appreciate that. It's a long book to get through. I know it's like 400 something pages long, but I was like you. I had no real interest in sports before working on that book. And that book, in some ways, it's about me becoming a basketball fan. Mm-hmm.
We can get to it, but like, did that carry over?
I'm still following. I haven't watched a full game in a really long time, mm-hmm. but I definitely am still following. Like right now, I'm from the Bay Area. I'm not supposed to be rooting for the Lakers, but I am.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a real sports fan thing.
I know. I think it's because of what you're talking about, right? Like, it's the same kind of thing. I sucked at sports as a kid, but mm-hmm. what really drew me in was realizing that it's like the source of story. You know, it's like another way that human beings construct narrative. And right now, in our current season, which is like one of the weirdest NBA seasons ever, I think that the Lakers have the best story.
The thing is, it's all kind of in the book, but, you know, like how did you... Like, is the story of how you came to this, you know, pretty much the same as what's in the book, or is it more, you know, you're looking around for the next thing to write about and you sort of stumble on this team that's been right in your backyard? Is that basically how it actually worked out?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a little more streamlined in the comic itself, but I do talk in the end notes about how basketball had been invading my life up until that point, right? So Dragon Hoops is all about this high school team that I followed for the 2014-2015 season. It was the team of the school where I used to teach. I used to teach high school computer science. But before that, like, I have a 16-year-old son, and when he was in fifth grade, he joined his basketball team at his school, so I started having to go to games. You know, I had no interest in going to games at all, but I had to go because my kid was on the team. And then all this stuff kind of happened. Like Jeremy Lin happened in 2012, and that kind of piqued my interest. Like, I couldn't understand why I cared. Like, I never cared about basketball, but here's this kid that kind of looked like he, you know, grew up in a neighborhood similar to the one that I grew up in. And suddenly I was interested in the sport. So
was that really a thing where if you're seeing somebody, you know, who finally looks like you, not a ton of Asian players in the NBA, certainly not up until 10 years ago or something like that. Uh-huh. Was that like a link for you that hadn't existed before?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And it wasn't even one that I thought I would care about.
Right.
You know, like, if you had asked me before Jeremy Lin emerged, would this make you care about basketball? I would have been like, nope. But then it was, it's the same thing that we're talking about earlier. There was a story that came out around him about, you know, how he got passed over for college, you know, even though he was on a California State Championship team and he was the MVP of that team, he didn't really get any offers from colleges. And just the fact that he ended up in the NBA was kind of a miracle. And then he goes on this crazy run. It was just a really compelling story. It was an incredibly compelling story. And I think the fact that he was like, I mean, he's an Asian American guy from the Bay Area. And I grew up in the Bay Area. Like, there are multiple people. I think he's like one degree removed from me. You know, like, I have a friend who is a friend of his family's. So all of that kind of made me interested.
So, you know, part of this is the story of this team, the Bishop O'Dowd Dragons. And by the way, my high school was the Dragons too, which after a little while I didn't realize it. I was like, wait a minute. Oh, I was the Dragons. That's why.
Wait, where'd you grow up?
Brunswick, Maine. Very, okay. Very far removed from that. Not a good team. But it isn't just that. There's also a history of the sport, and I think that one of the things that you get into, it's like you don't just learn about this team that's going on. You seem to have delved sort of into the history of basketball, and whenever you delve backwards into the history of a given sport, it seems like it tends to mirror culture. That's why, you know, like, Ken Burns baseball is my favorite. I could not sit through a baseball game in my life, but I've watched Ken Burns baseball through 3 times. So at what point in this did you start thinking about the team and then start researching basketball? Was that, you know, part of the whole process? And I guess because there's so much in here that sort of synthesizing it into one work seems like it would have been a really big process.
Yeah. When I first proposed it, like I started paying attention to that team. I got to know the coach, and it was really the coach's story that cemented it for me. Right. Like it ended up being chapter 1 in the book, but he told me this story from when he was a teenager, from when he was playing on that same team that he was now coaching. And I found that so compelling. First, I thought he was lying. Mm-hmm. But then he gave me the game tape, and I realized, oh, my gosh, he's telling me the truth. And it went down exactly the way he described it. So that got me interested. But then because I was a basketball newbie, because I knew nothing about the sport, I started feeling really intimidated. And to deal with that intimidation, I did homework. I started reading about basketball history. In the beginning, it was just to get to know the sport. I wasn't planning on putting any of that in the book. But then I think it's like exactly like what you said. Like, the history of basketball mirrors the history of America. And that's what really got me. That's what really hooked me.
Where do you start when you're like, I'd like to learn about basketball? You go into the library and say, where's the first basketball book? Like, where do you begin with that?
Yeah, I don't know. I looked around. So actually, the very first book I remember reading intentionally was Slam Dunk, you know, that manga book. I read the first 5 volumes just to see how people, like, I don't know if I read that many sports comics before that. So I wanted to see how somebody would do sports and a comic. And then after that, I read a football book. I read Friday Night Lights, you know, I did all three iterations. I read the book, I watched the movie, and then I watched the television series. And then there's just a bunch of like these one season books, right? There's one called The Breaks of the Game, about the Portland, Oregon Trailblazers, mm-hmm. way back, I think in the 70s or 80s. And then there's a book called Skyline that does a season it's very similar. It's actually a high school team in Oakland, and they follow them for a season. Mm-hmm. They're all prose books, but I looked at a whole bunch of them. So I started with books that were kind of similar to what I wanted to do, and then I branched out from there into like just reading straight up basketball history books.
This is how nerds get into sports, by the way, because I'm like, those are good books. I have also read all three versions of Friday Night Lights, and I have very cogent thoughts on all of those things.
That's right.
So, you know, at the same time as you're putting it together, like where did the structure of the story come from? Because it is one of those things where at first, you know, it feels as if it's jumping around and there's a point and a direction. I'm curious how you approach that as a storyteller. You know, how early do you have it sorted out, or is it just sort of sketches until you get to, you know, what you want your book to be?
Yeah, I'm pretty meticulous in planning now. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of outlining. I thumbnail the whole book before I started drawing it. And then even at the thumbnail stage, it went through multiple iterations. So first, second books, the publisher, mm-hmm. We have like this internal, it's almost like a critique group of cartoonists that are published by First Second, mm-hmm. and then we'll get together from time to time on on Zoom, and we will critique each other, you know. So in that format, I had shown all of my thumbnails and gotten notes from all these cartoonists that I really respect.
It's a prose outline to begin with?
It began as a prose outline, and then I did really quick thumbnail sketches of the whole book, chapter by chapter. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I had figured out the structure. So it began as just, I was just going to focus on the team, and then I started bringing in some history, because I felt like reading about the history of women's basketball affected the way I watched men's basketball, you know, or reading about like the Harlem Globetrotters versus the Lakers back in 1948 affected how I watched this game now. Mm-hmm. So I wanted that to happen for my readers as well. So I started sticking in the history at that point.
How long from sort of the time where you first had the germ of the idea, or you'd said, this is a thing I'm going to work on, before it sort of took shape into a form that we would recognize now? And then from there, how much longer is it that, you know, you're actually drawing the thing and really building it?
It took forever. That book took so long. It took me 5 years to do from beginning to end. And I don't know, at the end of the season, I had a rough idea of which games I wanted to include and what players I wanted to include. And then I started figuring out where the history would hook in. And by like, I don't know. It took me a year and a half before I kind of had the structure really solid.
And this is with a day job and a family and doing this other stuff.
Well, I guess. Because I had when I was following the team, that was my last year teaching. And then after that, I left and I started working for DC Comics. So mm-hmm. I guess at that point, my day job was writing. I was writing Superman. I did 10 issues of Superman. So that's what I did for the first year. While I was working on Dragon Hoops.
And I guess sort of to get into the cartooning of it, one of the things that I found is really interesting is that, you know, in comics, I'm putting air quotes around it, so many things are, you're able to tell people apart by the costumes and all that stuff, and you've got your cartooning to rely on, but, you know, no costumes like that. And so you've got all these different versions of humans, you know, real people that you need to be able to tell apart. And there's a bit where I'm sorry, the Punjabi kid whose name I'm trying to remember.
Jeevan.
Right. And, yeah. You know, and you talked about how you had to draw his hair a certain way so that he didn't think it looked stupid and you look cool, but he didn't look like one of the African American kids. And I just thought that was really interesting. I don't tend to think about that process, especially in, I guess, documentary type comics. You know, I guess, you know, how did that come together for you? Did you just sort of start with a bunch of sketches and then refine them over time?
Yeah, I was sketching the kids during the season. So I put it up on Tumblr, you know, and for the most part, they did not give me any feedback on it, but I would hear it. Like I'd hear it from the coaches. I'd be like, one of the coaches would be like, you got to change the way you draw this kid because the other kids are making fun of him for it. And there'd be stuff like that. And Jeevan was like that incident in the book where Jeevan comes and asked me to redraw his hairline. That was one of the few times where a kid actually came up and talked to me about how I was drawing them.
Yeah.
So it was, I feel like it was kind of an organic process. Like throughout the season, I would just do these sketches and I'd try to figure out how each of the kids look. And I teach with another cartoonist, or I taught with another cartoonist, Tin Pham, who right now is doing this amazing webcomic on Instagram. And we've collaborated together. He's also been published by First Second. He would like critique me, you know, he would see some of my sketches and be like, that does not look like Ivan. And then we would sit in his classroom after school and we'd try to work it out on the whiteboard.
It's one of the things I really like about the art of cartooning is that sort of distilling down, you know, into somebody who looks like a human, you know, and you can see there, you know, that there's a real person behind it, but also it's so minimal, and you've got to communicate that with every panel, you know, that this is that person that you're talking about. You know, and you've got a bunch of kids who are, you know, mostly black kids. They're different heights, but they've all got, you know, like the one kid has a tattoo. I'm like, all right, that's him, you know, and his hair is a little different. It's just part of the artistry of cartooning that I love. It's just such a cool aspect of this art form, I think.
Yeah, I think you have to get all of your characters to look different, right? In order for your book to be readable, they all have to look as nearly instantly recognizable as you can. And that's actually, I mean, when I was a kid, I remember thinking this, reading superhero comics. Like a lot of the times, I just felt like when they were out of costume, it was hard. It was hard to tell who was who. And I think it's different now. I think there are plenty of great artists. I think Dan Mora is one of them, who the characters look different when, even when they're out of costume, you can tell who's who.
Yeah. I had a friend and he drew an Avengers book once and the team was like Captain America and Clint Barton. And so there was like four blonde white guys. And he was like, it was a nightmare. I just didn't know what to do about that. Without the costumes, it was a whole thing. So what I found was interesting about this is that I did not necessarily expect. I saw Dragon on the front. I saw your name. I thought this will be some sort of Chinese myth will be involved with this, and that was not the case at all. And I'm wondering, did this feel like a big departure for you as a storyteller?
Yes, it did. So it was colored by my friend Lark Pien, who had colored a couple of my other books before. She did Boxers and Saints, and then she also colored American Born Chinese. And like while we were working together, we had multiple conversations where we were like, dude, if we had known it was going to be like this, we would not have started this project. You know, so I mean, there's the whole like depicting real people thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was really, really tricky. I ended up having to get the whole book checked over by a lawyer. And then there's the whole like, I was like constantly struggling with this idea, you know, like by cartooning it, I was automatically lying because it doesn't look the way it does on my page, right? Like the action's simplified and it's more exaggerated than it actually was. And I was constantly struggling with this thing about how do you tell a nonfiction story in comics? And even beyond that, like for Lark, she had to use all these photo references. We were constantly looking up, like, you know, how uniforms looked for different teams in different parts of the country, and shoes. Shoes in basketball culture are a big deal. So we had to figure out a way of we had to figure out how to simplify it so that it's cartoonable, you know, but not still have it be recognizable.
I assume it must have felt like you were on the book for a really long time and it was pretty far out of your comfort zone. Like at what point were you feeling pretty comfortable with it? I would guess there's a lot of doubt, like what the hell am I doing? Pretty far in.
Yeah.
It doesn't read on the page, but it's so different.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But no. I don't know if I ever felt 100% comfortable with that. I mean, it's definitely the subject matter, but it wasn't just the subject matter. It was also just the fact that I was doing nonfiction for the first time.
Right.
That was probably the scariest part, was that. And it wasn't just like nonfiction about strangers. It was nonfiction about people who, like, I'm friends with, mm-hmm. you know, that I'm still in touch with even now.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because also, you know, I was thinking like some of them were students at the school where you were teaching at the time. And I thought that is a very fraught set of relationships.
That's why I had to use the lawyer.
Yeah, I imagine.
Figure that out. Yeah.
You don't want to have a Booby Miles situation.
But I mean, one of the things that came out with the lawyer was, well, because some of their games were televised, they are considered public figures to some extent. But I also, like, I was really wary of pushing too far, you know? Like, if they didn't want to share something, I didn't want to push into it.
Sure.
So I had to figure out how to deal with that, too, in the narrative.
Hmm. What's interesting is that you say it's the first time that you had done nonfiction. And in my mind, I had thought of American Born Chinese as a much more autobiographical book. So I actually read it after I finished this book, and I was like, oh, it's not exactly in the same way. And I had thought that sort of, you know, it'd been like however many years since it came out, and I hadn't gone back and read it. And I said, oh, this is not actually you in this book. I'm sure there's elements of it and everything. But and as I'm reading this book, I knew that I was going to be talking to you, and you're in this book all over the place. And I was like, I didn't know this about him. I didn't, you know, you're also sharing a lot about yourself.
Yeah.
How did you
yeah.
feel about that?
That was a little scary too.
It's
so
a very
American
indie
Chinese
comics thing to do, you know. But I realize if it's the first time that you've done it, you've been around for a while for it to be a new move.
Yeah, I've always been scared. You know, I remember being in my 20s and reading Joe Matt and being like, oh my gosh, yeah. I really admired his courage, but I just didn't know if I would ever be able to pull something like that off. And American Born Chinese, it's fiction, but it pulls pretty heavily from my own life. But that layer of fiction allows me to, like, it's protection, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with this one, you know, in the very first draft, one of the first drafts that I showed that critique group in First Second, I was only in the prologue and the epilogue, and
oh,
then
really?
They were like, you need to put yourself more into this book. So I did, but it was not super easy to do. My wife is actually also a pretty private person.
Mm-hmm.
So we had lots of talks about how she was going to end up in the book and what she would look like in the book.
She comes off well in the book, which I think was a good choice on your part.
Well, thanks. Yeah.
The idea, she's the smarter
unhappy
person in the house,
yeah,
who keeps you where you need
she
to
definitely
be.
She definitely is. But she's still unhappy with the way I draw her hair. She's like, my hair does not look like that, which is true.
You're giving her anonymity. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, exactly. That's what she wanted.
So let me leave that behind for now and go back. How did you come to comics? Were you, had you always wanted to work on comics, or was that a thing that came later?
When I was really little, I wanted to be an animator, like in early elementary school. I really wanted to be an animator, and I like would try to draw in that Disney way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then in fifth grade, I started collecting comics. DC Comics number 57 presents. DC Comics presents number 57 was my very first comic. It had Superman in it, and it had the Atomic Knights in it. And after that, I was kind of hooked. I bought mostly Marvel comics when I was a kid, but I loved it. I loved comics. So ever since then, I've wanted to make comics. So I made some comics when I was in fifth grade, and then on and off throughout high school. And then after I graduated from college, I started self-publishing. So that was like, you know, like Jeff Smith and Dave Sim and Colleen Doran, mm-hmm, had all been self-publishing for a while there. And there was information about how to do it on the internet. So I looked up the information and I started figuring out how to do it myself.
And when did you come to the sort of realization that there was such a thing as comic creators? There's people who did this as a job. I mean, obviously, you know, you were a computer science teacher, so you didn't take that as your main route. But you know, was that, you know, did you think that it wasn't achievable? Or
my parents, especially my dad, were always very adamant that it was not a viable career path. Mm-hmm. You know, like comics are not a viable career path.
I've been in comics for a while, and he has a point. But
exactly right. That's what I think now too. I think he has, like, now that I'm in my 40s, I'm like, dude, my dad totally had a point. But I would go to comic book conventions, mm-hmm, and I'd see these people sitting up on panels, and you know, they're all clothed, they look like they've been eating. So I just thought, some people are doing it. Some people are doing it. But then it's exactly as you say, right? Like, once you kind of get in, you realize, oh, it's actually a pretty hard thing. I remember having a conversation with Arthur Adams, who's one of my favorite artists when I was a kid. And it was one of the first times I'd ever met him. It was at a convention. He was sitting at his artist alley table by himself. There was no line.
That always stuns me when there's like a legend. Right? You're like, come on.
Yeah, you're like, in Don Rosa, that happens to Don Rosa all the time. Yeah. I'm like, do people not know who this person is? But I was talking to him, and he's like, he told me that he had to also draw video game covers in order to make ends meet at the time. I was like, dude, you are Arthur Adams. How is that even a thing? But now that I'm in comics, I realize why that's a thing. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because there is the bit in Dragon Hoops where you are contemplating, you know, moving along to doing comics full time, and I had like a little, ooh, I don't know if that's a good idea, because also I'm in the future, so I, not for you, just for comics in general and media and everything. There was that, actually, and I meant to bring this up. There is that motif of the step through the whole thing, which I really appreciated and liked. How early did that come as part of it? Because it's sort of littered throughout the whole thing, and I was like, well, what's this? And then by the end, you know, it's pretty clear what that is, and it's such a can-do kind of thing that has to do with sports and everything, but it's, you know, very positive, and I love it as a concept.
Oh, well, thank you. It happened during the season. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just struck by how courageous it was for these kids to step out onto that court. You know, like at some point during the season, because I had never been an athlete myself, I never made this realization. But at some point during that season, I realized, you know, a lot of the things that are happening on the court, these kids are going to remember even when they're old, old men. Yeah. You know, like they're going to be 60, 70-year-old men. And these are going to be some of the most vivid memories of their entire lives. And some of these memories are going to be bad. You know, like I watched some of them flub the ball or like miss a shot or air ball or I heard the crowds booing them and stuff. I was like, those are pretty high stakes for a teenager. That takes a lot of courage to step out onto that court with those stakes, you know, knowing that what happens is going to stay with you for decades.
Can I give you a real life example of this, and then we can...
Yeah, please.
So I am not a natural athlete. I never have been. I'm not good at it. I'm not fast. I don't jump well. I played pickup basketball with my friends in the first part of high school because that's who was there. And I was like, well, I guess I'll do this thing. And I really, it was like Jordan was a thing then. So it was like, it was sort of the time. And I'd never played sports in any way, like organized. And I worked my ass off and I got put on the 10th grade JV team. I'd never played organized sport. Right. I never played though. I worked so hard in practice and everything, and we lost by 40 every time. And I got like 10 minutes of time, and I had one shot. I got one shot and it was an air ball, and I'm 43. Like I can live in that moment. I know exactly what it's like. It's terrible. And to hear you describe it that way, you're absolutely right. And I don't even have the glory days, and I'm self-effacing enough that I can see why it's funny, but no, you're absolutely right. That totally sticks with you. So yes. Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something about the teenage years in general that just stick with you, right? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. Moments like that are just, I think if they happen to you as an adult, it's not as big of a deal, but for whatever reason, everything's just amped up.
Yeah,
when you're in high school, you should write a piece about that, man. I feel like there's more of a story there.
There's a whole thing. I think I could go with that. So let me. You're seeing the kids do that. Like, do you as you're doing it? Do you draw a parallel to like, you know, in comics that is just as terrifying and risky, and you're putting yourself out there. You know, when you put your first self-published work out, or did you not think of that like that till later?
Yeah, it was actually, so what was happening during that season was my agent got a call from DC Comics with that offer to write Superman, and that felt really scary to me. My initial instinct was just to turn it down, mm-hmm. because it
like
felt
that
like
first, a, it, like I can't do that. like the first instinct to do that.
Like I was really excited, and then I was also like, I don't know if I should do that. And it was also like walking away from a regular paycheck and this school community that I really love that I'd been a part of for, you know, almost two decades at that point.
Wow.
So there are lots of things that felt really scared of me, and that was the connection between being like my own life and what I was watching on the court at the time.
So I assume you went to school for computer science?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Yeah, I got a degree in computer science.
And then you started teaching. I'm guessing either there were two decades. It was pretty soon after.
It was pretty soon. I worked as a software developer for a couple of years, and then I realized I didn't like it that much. And it was fine, but I would have rather been a teacher, so I applied for a job when I got it.
So it's always interesting because, as I understand it, software engineering is a very fine line of work. But I've always thought I don't think I could literally do that. And you're a person who's got this degree, but also, you know, there's a very strong creative streak in you and a desire to make things and draw. Like, do you feel like those were at odds?
Sometimes I actually think, you know, now that I'm a little older, I do think, I mean, software development, coding is actually a very creative skill, right? But you just have to put yourself in the right spot. I think there's some coding jobs where things feel a little more rote, and then some coding jobs where it requires a lot of creativity. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I mean, I felt like maybe I didn't look hard enough, but at the same time, I'm really happy that I got to teach.
Well, that was my next question. I mean, you did that. It seems like you had an affection for it. Like, did you enjoy being a teacher?
Yeah, I really did. I really did. I actually like after American War Chinese came out in 2006, and pretty shortly after that, I went part time at my job. So we were we were on a block schedule. And what that meant was I only had to go on campus every other day. So that was like, I did that for years where I would stay at home one day to work on my comic. And then the next day I would go and teach. And it felt like it was so balanced, you know, like teaching is really extroverted and making comics is super introverted. Mm-hmm. It just felt really balanced.
It's interesting because I think, I don't know, I had it in the back of my mind somewhere that you were a teacher, but for some reason in my head, I had turned that into art teacher or something like that. And then so I was reading the book and I said, oh, computer science teacher. And then I was like, that's a lot of stuff going on for some reason. I don't know why I did that. But so let me go back, I guess, to, you know, you end up with this degree. You're going to look into being a software engineer. Like, are you making comics all along, like as you're doing this other stuff?
Yeah. I was self-publishing all the way through, like pretty soon.
When did you
within
start?
A year of graduating college, I started self-publishing. And then I would just do it, you know, it was just the side thing. So, it was easier before I was like married and stuff, but I would just like, anytime I got home from work, I would just work on my comic. So, you know, I had a roommate, he would watch TV, and then I would kind of watch TV and kind of be working on my comic at the same time, you know?
What was your goal with making comics? Like, what kind of comics did you ultimately want to make? Did you want like a career in mainstream comics, or did you... You know, you're a writer and an artist, but you've you know, written some things without drawing it. Like what was your ideal? What did you hope to do?
In the beginning, it was just to self-publish one book. You know,
really?
Like in the very beginning, I just thought if I don't self-publish a comic before I die, I will die unhappy. So I have to do one. So it took me a whole year. It took me a whole year to figure out the printing process and, you know, figure out what Diamond Comics was and all that kind of stuff.
So it's not even just like doing it, but like literally self-publishing and getting in stores. Is that Gordon Yamamoto, or was this earlier than that?
Yeah, that was it. That was the first thing I did.
That's your first work.
Uh-huh. That was the first thing I did. Yeah. Yeah. As an adult, that was the first thing I did as an adult. And then, you know, I was going to comic book conventions at the time as well, like while I was working on Gordon Yamamoto. And that was a really bleak period in comics. So this was like late 90s. Marvel Comics had just declared bankruptcy. And I remember like going to my first San Diego, and on the Sunday of San Diego, it was like a ghost town in the exhibit hall. You know, it felt like there were more exhibitors than there were attendees.
I remember that.
So I
went in 2000 the first time I ever went.
Okay. So it was around the same time, right? Like, so you remember.
It was a whole other thing. And like, you know, 5 years into that, like I won't go now. I mean, I don't get paid to do it anymore anyway, but I'm like, it's not. it's too much. It used, like, that first year I ever went, I had never really experienced comics, and I remember standing there and looking to my left, and, you know, Will Eisner is just standing there, and it was still early enough that a lot of those guys were still around and you could see them, you know. And I just thought, this is amazing. This would be like if you were a film fan and you went and Martin Scorsese is just standing there.
Exactly.
And over the next span of years, it changed, you know, because celebrity got more involved with it and everything. But that first bit, and San Diego was big, but it was more than just like everyone was there. If you wanted to talk to somebody, they were right there. And I was amazed. And that changed, I think. Anyway.
Yeah. That totally changed. It felt much more like a small town, right? Like the comics industry was a small town. But I do think there was also, at least in the, it was starting to evaporate in the early 2000s, but in the late 90s, there was like a certain kind of depression that was in the American comic scene. I remember hearing a panel where they were comparing comics to poetry. Like somebody was comparing comics to poetry. And not in a good way. So no offense to poets out there, but what they were saying was, you know, poetry used to be a mass medium. Everybody who could read would read poetry. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of dwindled. And now it's like this real niche market where you have a tiny group of people, relatively speaking to the population of America, writing and reading poetry, right? And his prediction was that comics was going to go the same thing. It was going to get smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller to the point where it'd be this tiny niche that was just producing it for themselves and nobody would be able to make money off of it. So when I heard that, I was like, I'm never going to make a career out of comics. I'm just going to do it for fun because I want to be part of that niche, right?
So when you went at that, you know, like, I mean, I don't know who ruined your dreams, but like when you went at that point, were you like, was there a point where you think maybe before Gordon Yamamoto where you thought I can make this my career, or did that sort of come along later?
It was pretty early on. I don't remember who said that, but it was pretty early on that I was like, this is not going to be a viable thing, you know, it's not. So, and I was like going through a really snobby period where I had discovered alternative comics. So I wasn't interested in, you know, doing anything for the big two. Mm-hmm. So it really didn't seem viable at all. You know, I remember Jess Smith. I'd really admired Jess Smith, you know, read all these interviews about how he built his career and started self-publishing. And then I remember he went with Image Comics for a little while. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of like it felt like he did that. I don't know if this is true or not, but from the outside, it felt like he did that because he was like taking cover in a collapsing market. It was just really like to go from how the comic book industry felt in the 90s to now is just like it feels like a miracle. It feels like a dream.
Yeah. And you know, it was such a weird time, you know, and it's just, I don't know, we could go over on that stuff forever, but you made it through is the point. So, you know, like when you're working on Gordon Yamamoto, did you have I have read it, but it's been a while.
You don't have to read that.
No, I have. I like it. I do.
Oh, thanks.
Well, you know, like I have a thing about, you know, smaller stories and like that kind of cartooning. And I think that at that time of year, at that time in comics history, there was more of that, and it's kind of not a place for it now. Like, you know, that indie comics move in the late 90s, early 2000s, that's like my favorite thing, you know.
Yeah.
So many wonderful kinds of stories come out of that. You know, like, what, I guess, like, what kind of story was it you were wanting to tell, or what kind of mark did you want to make as a cartoonist?
Yeah, I guess I should say that. So we just talked about how the 90s felt kind of depressing, but it actually wasn't all of comics that felt depressing, right?
Sure.
I remember, like San Diego felt depressing, but then Ape felt alive, right? Mm-hmm. The Alternative Press Expo felt alive. And it's exactly what you were talking about. Like there's sort of this no money, no rules kind of thing where people were like, I'm not going to make money on this anyway. So I'm just going to do exactly the kind of comic that I want. And a lot of the mini comics that were coming out. I remember finding a Matt Madden comic in the around that time and just being kind of blown away by it. He had like silk screened the cover. Mm-hmm. And it was like this Xerox thing, but it looked so beautiful as an art object.
I think that was a time where you could find things that spoke to you, and you're right. Like, the, I mean, people were making a living out of it, but the risk was, you know, it was just them, but you could still sort of get somewhere. I remember, I always think of Box Office Poison as the first sort of story I read.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
Where, yeah. You know, like, I read that book. I read it in one day, and I know that Alex had worked on it for years and years and years and years. You know, and I've never read anything like this. And, it, you know, you live in it for a while, and I don't get books like that anymore, but it seems like they're everywhere at that point. Strangers in Paradise or...
yeah,
you know,
Strangers in Paradise.
Dozens of other things, and I'm constantly looking for books like that, but they're harder to find. In the same way, I think First Second is a place, you know, where there's some more of that. Top Shelf isn't quite as reliable in that way as it used to be, but you know, Jeffrey Brown back then, like that was all sort of coming.
Right.
It was a really good time.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. It felt like really, really personal work was mm-hmm. was coming out really rapidly, right? There's a certain intimacy in those stories.
Yes.
That I guess maybe is a little harder to come by now.
I'm sure it exists. I think it's just harder to find. You know, it's hard to get noticed and sort of oddly enough. I don't think the internet's actually helped those people.
Yeah, I think that aesthetic of being personal and vulnerable mm-hmm. has like a lot of the comics in the middle grade and YA space, it kind of comes out of that tradition, right? And it's not Box Office Poison, I felt like, was much more adult.
Yeah.
And Strangers in Paradise too was more on the adult side, right? So I do think there are comics that follow that tradition, but they're probably just aimed at younger audiences now.
I think it might have been a very Gen X thing at a very Gen X time.
Yeah.
Maybe we're not buying the comics like we used to, so that could be on me. Anyway, so I am curious about sort of the tradition, the trajectory you wanted to take as a storyteller, like what kind of books you wanted to do, how you wanted to be known.
Yeah, I think I just wanted to do books that I didn't even know if I had a real plan. I just wanted to do books that I wanted to do. Like I knew I gravitated towards magical realism. Mm-hmm. And early on, like with Gordon Yamamoto and the King of the Geeks, and I did a series after that called Loyola Chin and the Sam Pellegrin Order. I was just figuring it out. I was figuring out how to tell like stories within magical realism that had some kind of a fantasy element in it, but was still grounded in like everyday life. And eventually, I feel like American-born Chinese. That took me forever to do, too. That took me, like, 5 years to do. And that was, like, me really working on it. You know, like, I had done these two smaller stories, and I felt comfortable enough to dive into something a little bigger and a little deeper.
When you're doing a story like American-born Chinese, you know, do you feel like you are telling... Is it you're telling your story, and that's just what it is, or are you telling us, or are you trying to make a point about a Chinese-American experience? Because it's one of those things where, like, it's your identity, but when you say it, you're also making that the identity of the book. And I'm always interested in that as a thing where we're looking at sort of, I'm saying diverse because there's not a better word for it right now. But, you know, you are who you are. And when you put that book out, like, oh, this is a book about a Chinese experience, where it's also just a story, you know, about your experience. Like, are you thinking of that when you're putting the book together, or does that come up sort of later?
Yeah, I mean, I did think about wanting to talk about my cultural heritage, mm-hmm. for sure. Yeah, I mean, that was definitely the focus of the book. But it is my experience,
right,
of being Chinese American, and the reason why I did that was, you know, I'd done Gordon Yamamoto, I did Loyola Chin, I had these Asian American protagonists, but I just felt like the Asian Americanness was not, it wasn't front and center. But mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't want it to be either. But then at that point, I just felt like, you know, this is something I've thought about since I was a kid.
Yeah.
I want to do something where this is the focus. This is what it's going to be about.
Had that been a kind of story that you felt you hadn't seen a lot?
Oh, I mean, there's a mini comic at the time. I forget the guy's name who did it. That was called Yellow Kid. There are a few comics that were about that, and then you know there are like Asian American classics mm-hmm. that were out at the time, like in prose. Mm-hmm. I don't think I consciously thought about whether I'd seen that book or not. It was more, you know, I saw these books, that these graphic novels that I admired because of their intimacy, like Blanket, you know, yeah. or Goodbye Chunky Rice, a lot of the ones that you're talking about too. Yeah. And I just thought, if I'm gonna achieve that level of vulnerability and intimacy, it has to be about something that mm-hmm. means a lot to me, that something that's helped me figure out my place in the world, right?
It's very interesting how the sort of conversation has adapted, you know, since then. And so, like I said, I went back and I read American Born Chinese again, and I hadn't read it. What was it? 2006? I think I read it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at the time, you know, I'm reading through it, and I recognize a world of the 80s and sort of what at the time I think I would have thought of as innocuous racism. Because I was a little kid, mm-hmm. didn't know the difference. And then sort of to look back on it now and think, wow, this is, I lived in a horrible time. You know, like, for somebody like you or anybody who's a little bit different, is that it was just so normal and accepted to be shitty to people for no reason. And now we talk about this all the time, but I think that, like, this book for me was sort of the beginning of understanding that conversation. It's for me to go, well, I'm not a racist person. And then I would think back, like, and as little kids, we were terrible. And I like to think that they don't do that anymore. But, you know, is it difficult to cartoon about this? Because I'm reading, you know, Cousin Chinky, you know, is it hard to draw that over and over in a book like this? Because it's ugly. And also at the same time, you're kind of trying to make it funny. And there's a real difficult tension there, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the 80s were a weird time, right? The 80s definitely yes. were a really weird time. And that was definitely, I feel that way about myself too. When I look back, like, homophobic comments sure. in the 80s were just so commonplace. And it was almost weird if you didn't say it at school. Mm-hmm. That's how rampant it was.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of conversations that I think back to now that I have with friends that I feel ashamed of. Even about my own culture. I think you know, when I started realizing that I was different from most of my classmates, one way I took out that difference was by picking on the kids that were immigrants that had come, like, I was born in America, so I would pick on the Asian kids.
And you were, I mean, not you, but, you know, the stand-in for you and his characters, pretty ruthless. Like there's a couple
yeah,
of times I'm like,
yeah.
oh, that's terrible. And I've seen that theme, you know, in other books about similar experiences. And, I mean, I think that's the kind of brave, you know, like, raw sort of vulnerable thing that you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, for the Cousin Chinky character, it was kind of a fine line. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about this a lot, because I did American Born Chinese as a mini comic. So I was printing up, like, I don't know, 50 of them, and I'd sell 16 of them. Mm-hmm. I'd sell them through Comic Relief in Berkeley, or I'd sell them at, like, Ape, mm-hmm. you know. And so most of the readers of those mini comics I knew personally.
Right.
So I could be reasonably sure that they would take it the way I meant it. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes about how the story would have changed had I known at the time that it was going to become a graphic novel that would be published by a publisher, you mm-hmm. know?
So
I don't know.
How does that happen? Like, where do you go from being selling 15, 16 copies of this thing to having it be, you know, this real beautiful little volume put up by First Second? I know First Second showed up. There was that.
Appeared. First Second showed up. That was the big thing. And I was also friends. I mean, I still am. I'm friends with a guy named Derek Kirk Kim, who mm-hmm. I think is, you know, among the most talented cartoonists, you know, working today. So he does more work in animation now yeah. than he does in comics.
I remember his name in comics a lot more at the time of this book than now, so I guess
he got a real job.
So,
yeah, that's right. He got a job that comes with health insurance now. So he did a book called Same Difference mm-hmm. that came out in 2003, I want to say, and it won all three awards. It won the Eisner, the Harvey, and the Ignatz. And after that, publishers started approaching him for his next book. So one of the publishers was First Second. And at that point, they didn't even have a book out yet. They had just formed and they were putting together their first season. So Mark Siegel, the editor of First Second, he actually flew out from New York to San Francisco, and Derek invited me along. So Derek invited me along. I met Mark. After that, at some point, Mark read American Born Chinese. At that point, it was like 80% done, I don't want to say. And then he signed me up.
And then, it became a thing fairly quickly, it felt like, all of a sudden, that, you know, you had the It book.
It was a crazy year. Yeah, the year that it came out was nuts. I remember before the book was released, I went to San Diego and I did a signing at the booth, and they were like, you know, usually when I did a signing back then, I still have signings like this from time to time, but it would be like three people over the course of a day, right? And it wasn't like a crazy like Jim Lee line, but it was definitely more than three people over the course of that signing, and that was kind of shocking to me. And then after it came out, when it was nominated for the National Book Award, that was just a really crazy week.
How long was it the time from when it came out to when you got that nomination?
It was like maybe a month.
Oh my god!
Maybe a month. Yeah, it was pretty soon. Maybe two. It was a month or two. I want to say it was a month actually. Like, it came out in September, and I think I got the nomination in October. And I remember, like, being in my classroom, and a reporter walks in from a Chinese language newspaper wanting to interview me. And I just thought it was so crazy and weird.
Plus, people could apparently just walk into classrooms back then.
Right? It's because she did not know the protocol at an American school. Because she was a Chinese language speaker. It was like my auntie walking in and demanding to talk to me immediately while I was like in the middle of giving a lecture.
That's inappropriate.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Do you speak Chinese or no?
I do, but I speak like a 6-year-old dude.
Okay.
I'm not awesome at it.
It's one of the things in the book is that, you know, obviously you're very steeped in what I believe is real Chinese mythology. I don't really know to compare it to, but like, was all the mythology, you know, that is included in American Born Chinese, like that kind of stuff, are those, you know, stories that you grew up with and things that were like easily, you know, melded into your story? Or was that like also more research kind of stuff?
They were stories that I grew up with. Mm-hmm. My mom told me Monkey King stories when I was a kid, but I did also have to research it. And the version of the Monkey King that I do in American Born Chinese is very Americanized. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's definitely blended with Western elements. Mm-hmm. Originally, after Gordon Yamamoto and the King of Geeks, I actually wanted to do a Monkey King story. I wanted to just do a straight adaptation of Journey to the West. And when I looked into it, I realized there are like a billion adaptations of the Monkey King story of Journey to the West in Asia, and I didn't see a point in doing it.
Is there a? I mean, is the sort of analogy of him? I was going to say anglicizing himself, but just trying to conform. Like, is that part of that story, or is that something you'd add it to?
Yeah, there's he's so in the original, he's like super angry, mm-hmm. right? He's like really, really angry because the gods won't accept him. But there is, I would say, there's less self-doubt in the mm-hmm. original than in my version. Like in the original, he's just really pissed off and he just like beats everybody up, and that's kind of it. Like, and then he gets punished. And then he gets
and
punished.
Is he considered to be like a heroic character, or
he is? Okay, he is. Yeah, yeah. But the portion of his story that I adapted in American Born Chinese is just the very beginning. So in the original, he goes on to have all these adventures, mm-hmm. and over the course of those adventures, he achieves spiritual enlightenment.
Right.
So the story is about how he goes from this really arrogant, selfish character to being selfless.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So, the book is about to be released. Like, what do you think is going to happen with American Born Chinese? Like, you think it'll, you know, I'll sell some copies and we'll see if it's okay. Did you have any idea what was coming?
Yeah, I mean, my thought was, I did not see what I was coming. Mm-hmm. My thought was I was going to have this, you know, graphic novel that I could show my parents.
You've done it. You've printed a book.
Yes, you know, that I printed a book. Yeah. I mean, I think that was about it. That was mm-hmm. what I was thinking, you know, like. And then I had gotten an advance for it, which was much more than I was expecting. I just thought it would, it'll at least legitimize it to some extent with my parents.
Mm-hmm. So how does that change your life? When, in a very short order, it becomes
I mean, the biggest, most practical thing that happened was I got to go part-time at my day job, you know? And then it opened up a bunch of different doors of opportunity to me. Like I kept going with First Second, which I'm really grateful for. I did a bunch more books with them. Eventually it led to, like, I was able to do like a short strip with the New York Times. It was all that kind of stuff. I mean, it didn't really, I don't think it affected, like, I didn't go full time at cartooning until about 5 years ago. So a lot of my daily existence was still the same. But it was just like I had more opportunities, I think, as a cartoonist than I did before that.
It kind of sounds like the best of, I mean, I guess getting really rich and famous is one thing, but it's, you know, getting to do your work and being having the respect, but, you know, getting to still be yourself, I guess, to a certain extent. It's kind of interesting. Let me skip ahead a little bit, you know, from that, like, how do you get to Superman from that? And I know that you know, there's a lot of books that happen in between there, Boxers and Saints, which I feel embarrassed, but I don't know that we'll have a heck of a lot of time to talk about, you know, but that is a massive undertaking. And was it the Green Turtle? Is that correct?
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
That's before Superman too, right?
So it was before Superman. Yeah.
That stuff leads into there.
Yeah. Superman. I mean, that offer, just my agent, she had some kind of conversation with somebody at DC. I'm not even sure who, and that offer came about. And then I said yes.
Had you thought about that as being a thing that you wanted to do? I mean, obviously, well, you're working on something in Dark Horse.
Yeah, I'd been approached by DC before that.
Okay.
A couple of times, and I'd always turn them down because I didn't want to leave my day job, you know, and I was also focused on what I was doing for a second. So with Superman, Superman's just like, I mean, he's the character that it's just hard to turn down, right? Like Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, how are you going to turn those characters down? So when they made that offer, I was like, I might have to leave my day job for this. You know, so I, like I said, initially I was really hesitant. I wasn't sure if I wanted to do it. But after thinking about it, I decided to take it.
Did you have to come up with an approach to the character? Or did they bring you something?
It was a mix. It was a mix. I think I could talk about it now. But like the centerpiece of that 10-issue run was the reveal of Superman's secret identity to the world, right? Mm-hmm. And that was not my idea. That actually came from them.
Yeah.
And the fact that Lois Lane was the one to do the reveal, that also came from them. But a lot of the other stuff did come from, like, I just think I was entering into the DC universe at a really strange time, because the mandate at the time was they wanted to change all three of their big characters. They wanted to change Batman, they wanted to change Superman, and they wanted to change Wonder Woman, right? So I got in there, and the Superman that I wanted to actually write was the classic, like as classic of you can get of Superman, but that's not what they wanted. So I do think that tension was just there through my entire run. I have to say though, like my favorite thing about those, like working on those 10 issues, was I got to work with Greg Pak. We'd been friends for a little while before that, but I really got to know him during that year. Mm-hmm. I felt like I learned so much from him. And Aaron Cooter and Pete Tomasi.
Comic
pro, Greg is like he really is. Yeah, he's kind of a magic man. Everything he touches is awesome.
Yeah, I like him a lot. So as you're working on Superman, I mean, that's got to be a whole different grind than the kind of comics that you had been used to making. Was it a real culture shock?
Yes, it was. It was a huge culture shock. It was huge. Huge culture shock. Like first the monthly deadline cycle, I was not used to at all. Mm-hmm. And then I'd always assume that when you read like a 6-issue arc, that the entire 6 issues would be like meticulously mapped out. You know, the way I would map out a graphic novel. That's how I assumed it would be. It's not like that at all. I mean, I think actually there probably are some arcs that are mapped out like that, but at least in the books that I've worked on so far, it is almost never like that. Mm-hmm. Like you can do a super loose one, but things in the universe change and it affects how you tell your story.
Yeah. It's like you're always kind of dodging and moving and adjusting and
And you know who's great at that is Greg Pak. Greg Pak can take, like, the universe can totally pull the rug out from under him, and he will be able to come up with a compelling workaround. So that I felt like that was something I really learned from him, or I at the very least I saw modeled by him.
Mm-hmm. Actually, even sort of. I mean, I know that you'd collaborated with other artists, but really to collaborate in a storytelling thing, that must have been relatively new also.
Yeah, that was relatively new too. I mean, it was just, so I had done the Avatar comics before that with Gurihiro. Mm-hmm.
Right.
But even then, it was like 72 page volumes. The deadlines were not as tight as they were for DC. And it was not as rapid fire. And for those books, we really did that, right? So 372 page volumes were a single arc, and we like broke the arc. You know, I outlined the arc, and we went through it with a fine tooth comb before I started scripting it. So that's what I was expecting to do with Superman, but that wasn't how it worked.
But that was not, you didn't say I've had enough of all of this. And then I'm trying to remember if New Superman went concurrently with that or was after.
No, New Superman was part of Rebirth.
Right.
So I've
definitely lost track of the specificities of everything that's happened in DC over the past, I don't know how many years, but
it's a superhero universe, so it's all wonky. So that was the other thing too, is, you know, like, my experience of DC Comics before and after Rebirth was night and day. It just felt like a completely different place. Really? Writing in that universe felt completely different. Like things that felt like they were, I don't know, things that felt like it just felt like you were going against the wind. Mm-hmm. Before Rebirth. And after Rebirth, there was like this burst of energy that I feel like you can see. Like when you read the books that came out immediately after Rebirth, you could feel it in the books.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But none of the people had really changed. You know?
That's what I was saying. You were saying that, and I was like, well, that wasn't...
Right?
It's interesting.
Yeah. All the people were the same. And in some of the books, the creative teams were even the same. Mm-hmm. But it just... The book itself felt renewed. It felt different. And after that, I was like, I think the DC Universe has... like a personality of its own, even that's greater than any one person in the company.
The way that I think about that period is into Rebirth, and you know, I think of Geoff Johns is spearheading that, and then you know, that, I mean, when you say energy and you know, that sort of moving forwardness, that sounds like Geoff to me. You know, I think that I remember that as that being a thing at the time. It'd be, you know, somebody told me about his story conference with people, you know, and how we just break everything down. And I think DC is missing something with that right now. But I mean, is that what it felt like? Did you have
experience with that? I had a meeting with Geoff. Yeah. And at that point, that was my favorite meeting I'd ever had at DC.
Yeah.
It is because he's just such a wizard with story.
Yeah.
And to break down a story that I was working on with somebody who knew story so well was amazing.
Oh, I did a Q&A with him once. The first time I met him is they were doing it at Hanley's, and the guy was like, "Do you want to do this?" And I was like, "Sure." And I started to talk, and it was a big crowd. I don't think I'd ever done that. And I started talking about craft because I don't really know the details of everything. And I saw him go, "Oh, we can talk about story." And afterwards, he's like, "That was great because we got to talk." I was like, "Yeah, I don't know all the details of the superheroes going on." And like, it was one of the, like, up to that point, it was like my favorite creator sort of interaction I'd had.
Yeah.
In that same way. And I remember somebody telling me that he had, you know, had a meeting of those people, and he was like, tell me about that. You know, what's your word for Batman? And like, he's like, it's justice. You know, he could distill everything down to the most basic element that says what that character is. And I always think of that.
Yeah. He's stellar. He's amazing as a storyteller.
So tell me about New Superman, because that was a whole other thing. Was that yours?
That was not my idea. That was something that they brought to me. So DC wanted an Asian Superman, like a Chinese Superman. Mm-hmm. And at first I didn't want to do it at all. and then they kind of convinced me. I got convinced. I got like that same trip where I had a meeting with Geoff Johns. I also had a meeting with Jim Lee. So I'm a huge Jim Lee fanboy. Sure. I have like a bunch of Jim Lee X-Men comics at home. In my parents' house, and what he called me into his room, you know, he called me into his office. He told me that it was his idea to have an Asian member of the Superman family, and after that, I was like, I guess I have to do it because it's Jim Lee's idea. So I did. It was super fun. That was a ton of fun. Those 24 issues were great.
Yeah, you got time to run with that.
Yeah, I'm really thankful. They were going to end at 18, and then we got a little bit of a burst of energy, so we got an extra 6 out of it. It was great, and I got to work with for most of the run, it was Paul Kaminsky was the editor, and he's one of my favorite people in comics. He's great.
It's funny because he's I don't remember the character's name, but the new Superman, he's kind of a jerk. He's not a good dude, and you kind of bring him around, but he is kind of a jerk, and I always find that interesting from a storytelling perspective, that you've got to make him not likable. That's not the word, but you have to make him compelling enough for people to want to keep coming back. You know, is that how you looked at that challenge? I did.
Yeah. I thought of him as the Monkey King, and I thought of the Monkey King's arc.
I was saying it.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so I just thought that, here's this character that I loved since I was a kid, who's sort of a cultural icon in China. This book is set in China, so I just thought I would take this classic Chinese arc and apply it to Superman.
Was there any was there a reaction to the book, in the Chinese community, or did it get to China?
I've heard from Chinese readers. Mm-hmm. The biggest critique I've heard from Chinese readers is that it reads like an American wrote it, which is totally true. I knew they were going to say that. Like, that's one of the reasons why I didn't want to do it, was because I knew like there's an inherent Americanness in my approach to a story that I wouldn't be able to get rid of.
Well, you're American.
But, yeah, exactly. And I grew up on American stories. Yeah. I grew up within, American storytelling traditions.
But that blend and hybrid is supposed to be, that's the thing that's supposed to.
Yeah.
Connect all those things.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So I had to make peace with that before I even said yes. So I knew that was going to happen. But overall, I feel like, the feedback that I've gotten from Chinese readers has been positive.
Mm-hmm. I guess which brings us up to just this week, or when you're listening to this, probably will have been last week, your first issue of Shang-Chi come out from Marvel. Have you been away from... Oh, no. Oh, my God. I'm not skipping over Superman versus Smashes the Clan, by the way. I can't do it. that was delightful.
Oh, thanks.
Really, it was one, Connor and I, we do this podcast, and when that came out, that should not have worked in that way where you have a story that is taking place far in the past, and you're dealing with, very difficult subject matters, and it's Superman, and I thought it really rode the line really nicely, and sort of having a message and being fun but not being overbearing in either of those ways. And where did that come from?
Well, that was...
It was a radio show.
Yeah. It's an adaptation of an old radio show. It was a conversation that I had with Marie Javins and Bob Harris. Mm-hmm. And at the time, DC was just getting interested in doing something for the kids market, and we were talking about it, and this the storyline from the old Superman radio show I had read about in Freakonomics, so it always stayed with me. And when this opportunity came up, I proposed it, and they went for it. The big thing about that project is I got to work with Guru Hiru, who I had done 5 books in the Avatar The Last Airbender series with, and I just think that they're among the best cartoonists working in the world of comics right now. They're just so good,
That's two people. Because I remember we were talking about the book. I was trying to figure it out, and someone was like, "I think it's two people." And I was like,
yeah.
"Oh, I don't." And like, I don't think the website was in English, so I couldn't figure it out. And it was another one of those things that it just worked really perfectly, but it may not have seemed like it on paper,
Yeah.
Sort of. It wasn't like a fully manga style. It was again a blend For,
it was a blend.
For
we told them to blend Fleischer. We asked them to blend Fleischer Superman with manga, and they just I don't know, they nailed it. They're just so good. Everything they do is good.
Absolutely, it's 100%. No, I love that book. It was a real highlight, and it's one of those things where, oh, this is a perennial book. You can give this to people, and you know, it isn't sidestepping around the. I mean, obviously, it's Superman smashes the Klan, so it's very upfront, you know, with what it's saying.
Well, thanks. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for reading it.
No problem. I we've recommended it to many people. It's a great like gift kind of book. Like, oh, you have to read this. This is a thing. So now you're over at Marvel. You've gone across the not real hallway anymore, but and you're on Shang-Chi, bringing that character back. How'd that happen? How are you approaching the character?
So Darren Shan, the editor on the book, asked me to put in a proposal because they were talking about relaunching him with a miniseries because the movie was coming out, the movie that has since been delayed.
Like all movies,
yeah. like much of entertainment, at least live action entertainment, right? So I was never a Shang-Chi fan, but it did feel like an opportunity because he is right now at least the most prominent Asian American superhero character because of that movie, right? Because of all the announcement and the excitement about that movie. So I put in a proposal. He liked it. Darren liked it and signed me up, and we were running. So he was the one. He'd worked with DK Ruan, who's one of the artists on it before. And Philip Tan and I, the other artist, had been friends for a while. Oh.
Did he work on Superman some?
He did covers.
Okay.
He never did interiors, but he did covers in Superman for Superman and for New Superman.
Right.
But it's been super fun. It's been great. It's been a ton of fun. Yeah, Marvel's different from DC, right? Because Marvel doesn't have these like super hard resets. So that means that everything is still in play, even some of the problematic stuff. You just got to figure it out.
Yeah, did you have to, because if you weren't a fan, did you have to go back and, you know, there's not much recent history with that character. He shows up every once in a while, but it seems like that mostly lives in the 70s.
Yeah. I Darren sent me a bunch of old super like Shang-Chi comics, and I'd read the Marvel Max Shang-Chi way back when. But that, I think that was the only Shang-Chi that I'd ever really read. So he sent me a bunch of stuff. He sent me the old 70s comics. He sent me the more recent Secret Avengers stuff that I really liked.
So
I think
was
it was Ed Baker that did it.
Yeah. What was your take on the character after sort of going back, and then how did you decide to move him forward?
I mean, a lot of what Darren and I talked about was family. You know, so in his origin, I think the centerpiece of his origin is that he's this, he's the son of a supervillain, and the supervillain is not a problematic character, right? The supervillain is this problematic character, but we wanted to keep that idea that he is the son of a supervillain, and we just had to fill out the supervillain part as much as possible.
And when you say problematic, you mean terrible racial stereotypes.
Yes. Yeah. He's like the epitome of Yellow Peril.
Right.
But we just thought it was like most of us have issues with our family, you know, like there's always this tension between defining yourself as an individual and wanting to separate from your family, yet still like your family's always going to be a part of you. And I think there is it's not unique to Chinese culture, but it is characteristic of Chinese culture that there's this idea of filial piety, where your parents occupy a very important part in your life all the way through your entire life. And I think when your dad is a supervillain, that piece becomes even more amplified. So that's what we wanted to explore.
And I don't tend to think of you as a person who writes a lot of action, although, you know, you've done Superman, you did news, you know. This is a big action book. This kind of thing, you know. Have you liked doing that over the years? You feel more comfortable about it? Like, what do you think your strong point is with that stuff?
Yeah, I feel a little more comfortable with it, but you're right. I think that's like in any given story, the action is never the piece that's most interesting to me. And I feel lucky that I got paired up with Philip and with DK. I think both of them are great at action. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is me giving some minimal stage direction, and then they come out with these gorgeous layouts. Mm-hmm.
What's the thing that you've learned about, you know, working in, I guess, in mainstream comics and scripting, you know, for those kind of things that you wish you'd known when you first started doing Superman?
I think I've learned to be more flexible and more nimble as a writer, and to feel less attached to certain ideas, because things will change all the time. You know, it's not like with my graphic novels, I feel like I could take an idea and I could basically beat it to death. Like I could explore every single nook and cranny of it if I want to. But with superhero comics, I think you kind of have to hold ideas with an open hand and just trust that at the end of the process, things will come together well.
It's a whole process. So one thing I'm curious about that I always think about is that you are known in mainstream comics, at least, and in certain of your other stories, is that you do stories about Asian and Chinese characters. Do you ever feel like you're pigeonholed in that kind of thing? Would you like, do you feel like this is a thing I should be doing because it's good, you know, for all sorts of reasons, or you know, is that not the only thing I want to do? And by the way, I think you got out of this in Dragon Hoops to a certain extent, but still, race and culture is a giant part of that story.
Is that
just part of your package? Is that how it works? Or
yeah, I mean, I think I do gravitate. Like, I think the big thing, the big themes that interest me are all about identity, right? Mm-hmm. It's about. I have a friend who's a YA author, and she says that at the middle of every YA story is this equation. It's belonging plus power is equal to identity, and I think that equation kind of expresses what I'm most interested in terms of story. Mm-hmm. And I think in a multicultural country like America, race is just a part of it. Culture is just a part of figuring out what your identity is. So I feel like I naturally gravitate towards that. In terms of being pigeonholed, I don't know if I felt pigeonholed. I just think working in comics is like really, it's really hard. You know what I mean? Like I feel so lucky to be working in comics in any fashion that, I don't necessarily feel pigeonholed. I think, like for Shang-Chi, for example, like I wanted to do this project because it's about a Chinese American, but then like I did The Terrifics recently for DC Comics and I wanted to do that book because it's about a bunch of nerds, you know, like Mr. Terrific is like the biggest nerd in the DC universe. So I think, I mean, even that too is about identity, right?
Like, sure. Like, oh, absolutely. It's funny because the nerd thing is, I think, how people reach across the other cultural lines, you know, like,
yeah, that's
you
right.
Know, you and I can have grown up in very different places, but we're like, you remember Marvel Comics from the 80s? Yes, I do.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you've got that. It's the same way.
It's the same way.
So I do have to ask you this. You're the first official genius that I've had on my show. Do you tell people all the time? No, I'm actually a genius.
I tell my wife all the time.
Sure.
It doesn't work though. I'm like, do I really have to do the dishes? You know, I have a MacArthur grant, but I still have to do the dishes. I still am doing the dishes. No, that was another crazy thing. I feel like the last 5 years have just been full of really weird things.
I was in my car and I was listening to NPR nerd and they said your name in the MacArthur grant. And I went, what? And I don't mean that is not you, but like, you know, I don't know but I know you, you make comics.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, they're even looking at this stuff.
Exactly. So I got that call and I was stunned. Like it was in the morning and I didn't do any work for the rest of the day. I just couldn't get over it. And then one of the things that happens when you get the grant is you get to go to a retreat. So all the other people who got the grant the same year you did go to this retreat, and you do these presentations, right, about your work. So I do my presentation and I talk about comic books and, you know, a little bit about race and stuff. And I talk about Superman, and I was doing another book called Secret Coders at the time. So I talk about coding and comics and education through comics. Mm-hmm. And then the next presentation is this dude who is working on a technology that takes carbon emissions and changes them back into usable fuel. You know what I mean? Like, that's how that day went.
I mean, I would never take a single thing away from you, and I believe comics are very important. But, you know, like, if there was ever a situation where imposter syndrome would be, you know, like, did other people treat you like, oh, no, comics are greater? They're like, what's he doing here?
No, they were so nice. They were super nice. But I just constantly felt that way. Another person, he's a Native American who is his tribe. He comes from a very small tribe. And in the 1970s, you know, because of all sorts of horrible, horrible things, the elders made the decision to kill their language, to force everyone in the tribe to speak English. And what he did was he went through notes taken by Europeans who had stayed with his tribe in the 1800s and early 1900s. He reconstructed the entire language.
I've heard about this.
Right?
Yes.
He reconstructed the entire language, and he... And there's like a full college curriculum for it now. Like, you could just take it as another mm-hmm. foreign language. So he's repopulating the world with people who speak this language that had been dead for decades. That dude gave a presentation after I gave a presentation about Superman.
That's rad. That's the coolest thing. No, you should. There's feel. Don't you do not feel like you do not belong there. That's. Comics are fantastic. It was really fun talking to you.
Yeah, you too, Josh. This is great.
It was great. Well, you know what? I will let everybody know about Dragon Hoops as possible. That wasn't a sentence, but it's close. I've really enjoyed the work over the years, and it was really fun to talk to you.
Yeah, you too, Josh. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for reading my comics. Thanks for, you know, promoting comics as a medium. All of it.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much.
All right. Have a good day.
And that's all for this episode of Talksplode. Come back here in about 2 months, and you can hear the next creator we get on this show. I want to thank Gene Luen Yang for spending time with me and talking and hanging out. It's always fun because you'll meet the people who do great books, and you go, those are great people. And that is why I love doing this. You can go to GeneYang.com to find out more about him, or you can follow him at Gene Luen Yang on Twitter. And that is all for me. Go to ifanboy.com. You can comment on this show, on anything else that you would like to talk about, or all the shows and posts and everything that we have up there. They are yours for the taking. Thanks again to the patrons for supporting the show. You can find out more about that at patreon.com/ifanboy. And we'll see you soon. Junkies smoke and reefer kicks like it. They shoot the hoods. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They playing basketball. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like, they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which, again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people, and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened, because I think everybody's overburdened. But it can be tough to deal with. And also, one of the things is, like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right, so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ifanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's betterhelp.com/ifanboy.